A good morning to each of you. I appreciate that at least Jaron read chapter 5 in Nehemiah in preparation for today, and I hope that some more of you did. The journey we began with Jeremiah back in chapter 1 was 4 months ago, and the first call from Jeremiah was to, you might say, to fast and pray for our congregation. And that was 4 months ago in July that I preached that message. And I just wanted to inform you that this week on Thursday, those 4 months are up. If you made that commitment, maybe you'll want to continue it, but at least you are reminded that if you made a commitment there for 4 months to fast and pray for our church, that's up this Thursday. It was going to be, I hope that if you learned something from the Lord, perhaps it was a time of hearing from him, maybe you'll have opportunity to share that with one another. And a word from him about what our future is, what the Lord's vision is for the church. I encourage you to share that with each other as you can. This morning, we will be in chapter 5. Nehemiah has come to Jerusalem from Persia. He has begun the rebuilding of the walls around Jerusalem. Walls are for security and for prosperity and for identity. This was a symbol of where God dwells, and he was doing this under the direction of God. And as the wall was built, he pulled the people together, he drew them together, and with agreement, they worked together wonderfully and well. And during the astounding progress on the wall, Nehemiah faced, first of all, opposition from without, that is, from the enemies around. You remember Sanballat and Tobiah in chapter 4, how they opposed the work, they made threats, they organized to try to hinder the work of the Lord. Today, Nehemiah faces trouble within, that is, from the congregation or from the people themselves. And a leader can expect that. A leader can expect that where progress is being made for the work of the Lord, there will be opposition from without, there will be disagreement, tension, and stress from within. And Nehemiah gives us an example of godly and wise leadership for us, whether it's in our families, in our workplace, in our church, in our wherever we are or engaged. Nehemiah's example is instructive to us as he grapples with the problem. Here in our chapter 5, he grapples with the problem, he confronts the issues head on, and then he leads by his example. And so let's identify this morning the principles that he advances for the people of his time, and we'll also see what is relevant for us in our time for our finances. I call this message Financial Crisis in the Brotherhood. And if you'll notice as we read the chapter, the term brother occurs a number of times. They are very conscious of their relationships with each other. This isn't just a group of strangers that are plopped together here to sort of start and get acquainted. They see each other as brothers in the work there in Jerusalem. And we do that also, of course, in the church and in our relationships. Let's begin with Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1. Now, there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against the Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, "With our sons and our daughters, we are many, so let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive." There were also those who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine." And there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. Our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but it is not in our power to help it. For other men have our fields and our vineyards." I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. I took counsel with myself, and I brought charges against the nobles and the officials, and I said to them, you are exacting interest, each from his brother. And I held a great assembly against them, and I said to them, as far as we are able, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who have been sold to the nations. But you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us. They were silent and could not find a word to say. So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of God to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? Moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let's abandon this act exacting of interest. Return to them at this very day their fields and their vineyards, their olive orchards and their houses, and percentage of money, grain, and wine and oil that you've been exacting from them. And they said, we will restore these and require nothing from them. We will do as you say. And I called the priests and made them swear to do as they promised. I also shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out every man from his house and from his labor who does not keep this promise. So may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen, and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. The former governors who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them for their daily ration 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also persevered in the work on the wall, and we acquired no land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox, six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the food allowance of the governor because the service was too heavy on this people. Remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people. This interesting story in Nehemiah addresses issues they faced and we face in today's church. It addresses God's standards and principles for our financial actions and decisions and responses. First of all, let's look at the problem solving that Nehemiah faced. The complaints come in and they're loud. The men and their wives. That shows the extent of concern and issue that this was for them all. Not only were the men speaking, the wives were too. This was something that was affecting their whole families. And who did they speak against? Not against Sanballat and Tobiah out there. They're speaking against their fellow Jewish brothers. Did they organize a strike? There are strikes these days. It seems that the work stopped as they were facing this crisis. They were hungry. Now, as Jewish brothers, there was supposed to be a strong bond of connection and identity with one another. This had begun ever since back in the days of the Exodus. I mean, in the days of Exodus in Egypt, when the people of Israel migrated there, grew there, multiplied there, they belonged together. They were distinct from the nation around them, and they became slaves. And God delivered them as a nation out and brought them into the land of Canaan. Ever since that time, they have belonged together. They belonged together as family, as brothers. And God gave them laws. And some of them we had today in Sunday school lesson. About how you manage your finances and how you treat one another and how you take care of each other and those who are among you. And now they are, hundreds of years later, coming back from exile in Persia, Babylon. Some are recognizing this brotherhood, and some are not. Maybe they forgot. Maybe they and their families had ignored it. But those who have no land were short of food, and they were hungry. I mean, there wasn't enough gleaning to go around. The landowners who did have land, they were forced to mortgage their land because of the famine. Others had to, in order to buy food and pay the king's tax, they had to borrow money and mortgage their land or farm out their children, becoming slaves, actually. Why was this happening? Well, we got one clue. There was a famine in the land, probably a drought where the crops didn't produce. Probably also aggravated by the fact that people had come together at Jerusalem to build on the wall, and now there's more people and more mouths to feed and less food to go around. But then there's also taxes. The Persian king back there in Babylon, Persia, wherever he was, demanded that people all over the empire pay money into his coffers. That was a heavy tax. And likely it was felt that way and possibly was exploited of the people. In verse 8, Nehemiah says that he himself has bought some people out of slavery to the Gentiles. They had fallen on hard times. They had become slaves. They mortgaged their property, perhaps, and whatever, and were enslaved to the Gentiles. And Nehemiah did what he could, personally, to pay their bills, pay their indebtedness, and buy them out of slavery, only to realize that here they are without anything, and they're falling back into slavery, and this time it's to their fellow Jews. Now, Moses' law, and some of it we had in Sunday school this morning, debt servitude was permitted with certain limits. But outright slavery was not permitted. That you don't do that to a fellow Jew. Furthermore, you don't charge interest. If you loan money to a fellow Jew, you don't charge them interest. But these Jews, rich Jews in Jerusalem, had power, had position, had property. They were exploiting the situation. They were taking advantage of the poor among them. Until it raised an outcry. Nehemiah considered those concerns. He listened. The first mark of the leader is that he listens to the concerns. He tries to assess what's going on, and he does take action on that. His first response was anger. He was very angry. You notice that. He was very angry, but before he did anything, he took thoughtful consideration. He brought himself under control. I don't know if he counted to 10 or to 100 or whatever, but he took careful consideration, and his self-control brought this anger to where it could take positive and constructive action. And so apparently he knew how to cool down, how to listen to God's voice. The Hebrew word here indicates you give yourself advice. Well, let's be sure that we, when we get ticked off and we get angry, we give ourselves advice, godly advice to bring that under control. Even if it's righteous indignation, which it obviously was here for Nehemiah, it's got to be controlled. And we say that for our situations in the family and in the church and in the workplace. But God's law and standard had been disobeyed. Maybe they were ignorant. Maybe they were forgetful. Perhaps the famine was the result of their disobedience, and God brought the drought to wake them up. Well, now they're getting woke up. How often does it take for us till we learn that God's blessings are withheld when folks disobey his standards? Here they are, oppressing their own brothers. Perhaps that's the reason for the drought. Back in Leviticus 25, if you want to look it up, both slavery and charging interest were not allowed to fellow Jews. Family love, that matters. And that's got to supersede the love of money and financial gain and prosperity that way. Not charging interest of their own people, set the Jewish people apart as a distinct and unique people. They were different. And they were supposed to remember that. Their fathers had been slaves in Egypt, but by God's mercy, they were freed. And they too must show mercy to one another. If they were ignorant of Moses' law, or if they forgot it, Nehemiah knew it, and now he tells them. But you say, that was Nehemiah, that was Moses' law. What is there for us? What would Nehemiah say to us today? And so as a brief side trip here, let's take a look at what I've given you in the handout this morning. Principles of finance for believers. And these come from the New Testament. They're not that different from what's in the Old Testament, but they are gospel guidelines or gospel principles for the Christian lifestyle. And I won't spend a lot of time on these. They deserve each their own sermon. And there's only 10 that I've named here. There's room for 11 or 12 or even more. But let's start by where we start. Number one, God owns everything. God owns everything. You are not the owners of that car in the parking lot. You are not the owner of your property, your house, your farm. You are not the owner. You are only a manager of stuff that belongs to someone else, God. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The world and all they that dwell therein. That puts us in a whole different mentality and mindset. I manage this property, but it really belongs to him. Number two, God is our first consideration in all matters and decisions. It stems from number one, of course, but it says that God is the priority in my life and I will manage him, my issues, my properties, in a way that is giving him the first consideration there. I'll love the Lord my God with all my heart. Number three, serving others, the second command, love your neighbor as yourself. The stuff I have, the way I use it, is not for me to get and hold and clutch and keep. It's for me to manage in ways that promote his intentions, his purposes, and his plan. And so I spend and give wisely to benefit others. First, for my own family, of course, and fellow Christians, others that are in need, the less fortunate, the widows, the orphans, the aliens. Number four, God gave us in the concept of sowing and reaping a harvest, a beautiful example that's illustrative not only of material things, but also financial stuff. We plant seeds and then we sow a harvest. What do we get? We get more seed. Good for eating, providing food for the eater, but also some for saving for the next harvest, saving for the next crop, setting it aside to use later, setting it aside to share with others. Unless it's a bad season, there's enough in the harvest, both for the family and for others, other uses, other future needs. And God intends for us to use it that way. Not like that rich fool that Jesus told about. Bountiful harvest, oh, I'll keep it all for myself. I'll put up a bigger barn. I'll keep it here. I'll just rest and retire. Take ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God says, tomorrow you die. No, that's the mindset of the world, but God's people, we're living by God's principles, see that harvest, that bounty as his resource for sharing with others and helping them as well. And so, number five, generosity. Are you rich? Depends on who you compare yourself to. But the rich are to do good, be rich in good deeds, and be generous, willing to share. God loves a cheerful giver. Another principle to live by is to avoid debt. Some debt might be necessary, yes, as part of business operations and so on. The Bible recommends avoiding excessive debt, repaying all your debts that have no unpaid debts that are past due. Owe no man anything, Romans says. So what about that credit card? Are you living within your means? Can you pay that off every month? Or maybe better yet, just have a debit card so that you don't spend more than you actually have. Number 7, contentment. Avoid greed. Find satisfaction in your relationship with God. Live modestly, not extravagantly. Be content with things, and let your relationship with God and with others in the church be the primary focus of your life, where you find your joy, your satisfaction, and your contentment. Save, yes. Spend less than you earn and save the difference. Save it for, not for selfish purposes and building up your own account and trying to retire with whatever. Jesus warned against that selfish approach to building up treasures on earth. But rather, he says, would say, save it for future needs, for situations where you can help others, where you can responsibly provide for your family and your relatives, still trusting in God through it all. Number 9, care for your own family members. Not expecting the church or the government's going to take care of them. You do that. That's your first responsibility. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, especially for the members of his own household, he's denied the faith. He's worse than an unbeliever. Number 10, integrity. By that we mean concept of fairness and honesty and consistency and faithfulness. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. Well, more could be listed. These are the laws that Nehemiah would say to us today. These are the kind of basic financial principles that Nehemiah says, you ought to live by these, but you violated this one and this one. No wonder you're having hard times. So now let's get back to Nehemiah. Nehemiah was willing to confront those wrongdoers and do it head on. And I would say, as a leader, he shows us that correcting any problem begins by facing it head on. He went first to the nobles and the officials, the men with money who were responsible for this oppression and justice. Now, I would say, probably, from their perspective, they were just making good money. This was good business practice. They thought they were wise. This is the way that everybody does business these days. Charging interest, okay, taking people into bondage financially, bondage slavery kind of thing. But God is not considered so much with how much money we make, but how we make it. He is concerned and has directives for us in how we make our income. Here they were taking advantage of the poor, misusing their position of power at the detriment of others. Nehemiah confronted them. He first made a statement of fact. He told them what the law said, what God's principles were. He said, you're charging interest to fellow Jews. That's wrong. He said, you're enforcing permanent slavery of Jews. That's wrong. He said, furthermore, we're just losing our distinction in the sight of the nations. They're looking at us like, well, they're making bundle of money here, and that's just the way we do it. And you justify it by saying, well, that's the way business operates? Uh-uh. We are not the world. We don't operate the way the world does. God's people don't operate that way. Do you notice their beautiful response? They didn't say a word. They didn't have anything to say. They were guilty and they knew it. However, Nehemiah presented this to them, it hit them and they were silent. Verse 8, what a beautiful response. Then Nehemiah called a public meeting to address the matter. He called for drastic action, a change. He appealed to them in the fear of God and in respect of the enemies that are watching us. And then he appealed to them by his own personal example. Verse 8 and verse 10. We've paid to free some of these guys from the Gentiles, and now they're enslaved to you guys. And he called for specific action and immediate action. Do it now. Don't wait for the year of Jubilee. That's when slaves would be freed, you know, back in those days. Now is the time to stop wrongdoing. Stop charging interest. Return their fields and their homes to them so they can have a beginning and make their own living. Return the percentage of the money and the grain that you've been charging. Release them from their debts. Verse 12 and 13, they did speak. They made a verbal response and commitment. They did it publicly. They openly acknowledged what was wrong and what was right. They repented and made restitution. We will restore and do all you say. Can you believe it? Nehemiah preached to them and they responded to the invitation, said, we are wrong, we'll do it, we repent. Then Nehemiah called for the priests, said, you take note of this and you hold these guys accountable. As the third party, the priests were to be witnesses and to be sure they carried out their promises. Correction of a problem is best carried out when we make a promise. Correction of errors when we make a promise, preferably public. And then Nehemiah shook out his garment, the robes of his garment. He said, now, I want you to know this is the way God's going to shake you out if you don't keep your word. And it was sort of a little object lesson there for him. What happened then? There was a public response. The people that were listening were nodding. They were agreeing. This is right. This is appropriate. This is just. They all said, amen. And then they praised the Lord. Then they acknowledged God and they praised him and thanked him for this turn of events that was going to make such a difference in their lives. And then, verse 16, the work on the wall resumed. I think it was stopped during this crisis, this financial crisis that they were bringing to Nehemiah's attention. But now, at the end of the chapter, Nehemiah includes something that's very instructive for us. He talks personally about what he has been doing and how he has been living. Now, how he has been managing his own finances. I call it the power of personal example of the leader. If Nehemiah had not had his own example to back up on, his instructions would have fallen on deaf ears. They wouldn't have listened. But Nehemiah says, follow me. Follow my example. Here's my example. It's a matter of integrity with God. He continually lived in the fear of God, and he was not living for personal benefit. But this laid the response, this laid a foundation for the response of all these people for godly principles and godly living. And it resulted in harmony in the brotherhood, and it resulted in joy and praise to God, and it resulted in the resuming the work and the progress on the wall. For Nehemiah had lived above reproach. His own personal life was above reproach. Now, he had been appointed governor when he first came. And that might have been a few months ago, whatever it was. When he came to Jerusalem, he had been appointed governor. This was the highest position in the land, governmentally or politically. And he accepted that. But he did not accept it as a position or an advancement for power and prestige and taking advantage of others, of living it up for himself. Not so. Rather, he accepted this as a posture and a position from which he could serve the others, from which he could do something good for Jerusalem, where he could do something for his people, and then name and honor of God. And he was willing and desiring to be promoted, yet be humble in that. And so he accepted the role and the privileges, the responsibilities and the challenges. He accepted the ups and the downs, and there were some ups and there were some downs, but not for self-advantage. He knew that leadership means dealing with more than stones. Sometimes it means dealing with people with stony hearts. Sometimes it means dealing with people, and there you're going to have problems because we're all in a broken world, and we're all broken in our natures, in our sinfulness. People have problems. They did here. They do here. People have problems, sticky relationships, negative attitudes, criticisms, fault finding, complaints and grievances. But God had called Nehemiah and God equipped Nehemiah, and he accepted that. And he accepted it and experienced in it the grace of God to deal with this bad problem and others. And you see here how the grace of God in Nehemiah's life effected a positive transformation of the situation in Jerusalem at the time of this crisis. What an example Nehemiah is of servant leadership. Didn't Jesus say, "Rulers of the Gentiles lord it over"? Not so among you. We're together in this, aren't we? We're on the same level. We're brothers and sisters. Yes, we're talking about the brotherhood. This is a brotherhood, and Calvary is a brotherhood. Well, Nehemiah, led by his personal example of humility, he also corrected corrupt policies. The former governors who had been in charge before Nehemiah came had increased their taxes and probably kept some themselves. They required the people to provide for the governor daily rations to support his staff and his governor's table. And they appointed officials and servants to be ruling over the people. Nehemiah had a 5-word response to all that approach. "But I did not so." He didn't follow the usual protocol, the policies, the things that were allowed of a governor. That was his prerogative. That would have been his privilege, if you please. "But I did not do so." And he was willing to say no to oppressive practices that took advantage of the poor, to policies that were already in place. He was willing to say no to the normal way of doing business. "Well, of course we charge interest. That's just the way." No, Nehemiah wouldn't. He had the strength of character to correct those policies. He basically said, "Not on my watch. We're not doing it that way." Nehemiah came with a stable and a wealthy position, obviously. But he used that to help bring financial stability to others. He used that, and it resulted in gratitude and praise to God. He used that to help others find fiscal freedom in their own lives. It wasn't his power to charge more. It wasn't his power to receive that daily ration, to claim that for himself. But he didn't. Does this mean we can't enjoy special things, nice things that would come to us? We can't have those good things in our lives? No, not necessarily.
We must carefully guard that those things don't have us. We must carefully guard that the nice things we enjoy are still regarded as his property. I am a steward. I enjoy these. Use them for the benefit of others, for his purposes. So we must hold things that we have quite loosely, not clutching them to keep them to ourselves, but loosely hold them, use them. And if God chooses to take them, that's his prerogative, no big deal. But we use them as assets to bless and benefit others. Nehemiah lived in the fear of God. Here we talk about integrity. He recognized that God had brought him to this position. He took this as an assignment from God, and he will answer to God for how he spends his dollars, for how he uses his power and position. Are you conscious of God in all your life too? Nehemiah was unbending, except at the knees. He was unbending and he stood tall. He stood for God and he stood firm. And so the project continued. How? Nehemiah himself was out there with them on the wall. He himself, and he brought his servants along. He said, we're helping too. And he got with them. They were together in this. After all, this was brotherhood, wasn't it? And though he was in the position of a government official, the governor of the territory, he was there with them as brothers in the work of the wall. He knew that's why he was here. That's what his priorities were, and he stuck with those priorities. He invested his personal assets. You saw the food that he had to provide daily for all the guests and visitors that were at his table. Sometimes government officials were coming from other places, 150 people daily. And look at all the food that he provided at his own expense. So he wasn't building his own personal estate. He wasn't buying land to expand his territory. He already was wealthy, and he was spending his energy managing that in a way that would benefit others and help them. And so he demonstrated brotherliness by rolling up his sleeves and getting right in there and working with them. Nehemiah was generous. We've spoken of this already. His privileges that he could have taken and claimed, he did not claim or demand or expect them. But he fed all these people at his own expense. And as far as the other people are concerned, he was aware of the burden that they experienced. He was aware of the taxes they had to pay. He was aware of that, and he refused to exercise his own prerogative and do it for these people. Finally, and this is certainly, it's the last one verse in this whole chapter. Is another of those Nehemiah prayers. On the go, he's writing a story, and he inserts one little prayer. Just, Lord, remember me for my good, all that I've done for this people. Lord, I'm serving you. I'm looking to you for your blessing, your affirmation, your mercy. And so the chapter closes with a reminder that Nehemiah stayed in touch with his God. He looked to God, not only to guide him in his dealings with his money, but to use it in a way that furthered God's purposes here on the earth. And he looked to God for mercy. Well, Nehemiah's example of generosity and compassion, of serving others, his example is what gave him a power to be effective as a leader to God's people. You're not wealthy like Nehemiah. I'm not either. But Jesus would say, hey, even the widow had 2 pence, and she was a good steward of her 2 pence. She took care and she managed that as a steward of God's gifts to her. What has God given you? You didn't choose what family you grew up in. You didn't choose to live and grow up in this country where there's economic opportunities for advancement and for employment and for lots of plenty and nice things in life. You didn't deserve that by your own choice and an accomplishment. You didn't choose the kind of mind you have and your abilities to earn and do and invent. And those are gifts from God. Those are your gifts from God. Now use them. Use your background, your economic situation, your abilities in mind, the talents and special gifts you have as a gift from God. Be a steward. Steward it for God. Jesus did that. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you, through his poverty, might be rich. Nehemiah would say, live your life to benefit others. Manage your gifts, your finances, as God's steward. Manage them for God's purposes. Set the songs.